You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Becoming the Archangel Michael's Companions, Rudolf Steiner's Challenge to the Younger Generation. This is Lecture 9, given in Stuttgart on October 11, 1922. From what I said yesterday about the course of the human soul in historical evolution, you will have gathered that the way human beings confront their fellow human beings today is different from what it was before the year 333 CE. I assume that you are familiar with the members or sheaths of the human being, according to anthroposophical knowledge. You know that we must differentiate in the soul between what was active in human nature up to the 15th century, the so-called intellectual or mind soul, and the consciousness soul, which since that time has been principally active in those who have developed to the level of culture to which humanity has advanced so far. In describing a particular activity of the soul, such as that of the intellectual or mind soul, it does not indicate that the intellect, as we understand it today, is a special characteristic of the intellectual or mind soul. The intellectual or mind soul was developed particularly by the Greeks, and among them the intellect was certainly not what it is today. What is meant by the intellect today, you will have been able to gather from yesterday's lecture. Among the Greeks, concepts, ideas, were bestowed by the spirit. Because of this, their intellect was not so cold, so lifeless and dry as ours is today, which is the result of being worked out by ourselves. Intellectualism has first arisen through the special development of the consciousness soul. You can only get the right conception of the intellectual or mind soul by transporting yourselves into the mind of a Greek. Then you will certainly discover the difference between the relation of the Greek toward the world and our own. This will be made somewhat clearer by our lecture today. These introductory words serve as a basis to understand that in the centuries preceding the modern age, that is, up to the 15th century, human beings met and spoke to one another out of the intellectual or mind soul. Today we face the consciousness soul. However, human beings really could sense it only around the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, because of all the circumstances already described. Because of this, life questions appeared in an entirely new way. Certain life questions must be regarded in a new way today. Otherwise, the connecting bridge between consciousness soul and consciousness soul, which means, for modern humanity, the bridge between one person and another, cannot be found. We are suffering from this in our time, that we cannot find the bridge from one human being to human being. From human being to human being. We must ask many of our questions in such a new way that it may at first seem strange. It is not meant to be so, however. Now, let us suppose that a 3-year-old child were to decide not to wait until the 7th year of life for the second teeth to come in, but that this child were to say, "It would be boring to go through 4 more years until I get my second teeth. I want to get them at once." I could use other comparisons, which would appear still more strange, but this one will suffice. Such a thing is impossible, isn't it? For there are certain conditions of natural development. And so, too, it is a condition of natural development, for which today only few people have any sense, that only from a certain age onward human beings can know something about the connections in life, of which they must know, but which cannot be exhausted by information about external things. Naturally, already at the age of 9, we may know, for example, that the human being has 10 fingers. But matters in which a judgment formed by active thinking is necessary cannot be known before we reach a certain time in life, between about the 18th and 19th years approximately. Just as it is impossible to get the second teeth before the 7th year, so it is impossible before the 18th year, really, to know about those things that are not just under our nose, things for which active judgment is necessary. Before this, one could hear something and believe it on authority, but one could not know anything about it. Before the 18th year, we cannot unfold that inner activity of soul necessary to be able to say, I know something about this or that which does not lie in a region accessible merely to my eyes or ears. Such things are hardly mentioned today. They are, however, exceedingly important for life. If culture is to find roots again, one must speak about such things and treat them in a knowledgeable way. What then follows from the fact that before their 18th year, human beings cannot know anything of the kind? It follows that human beings, before they are 18, must depend upon those who are older, just as infants are dependent upon their mother's breast. It is in no way different. From this, however, there is something of the greatest significance for the interaction between teachers, educators, and the younger generation. If this is not heeded, the interaction is simply false. People are not conscious today that this is so, and do many things backward in the sphere of education. It was not always so. If we look back before the first third of the 15th century, something like today's youth movement would not have been possible. At that time, it would never have been justified to have a youth movement in the present form. It could not be. Why could there have been no such thing? To answer this question, we must turn to the especially significant conditions that were encountered among those preparing for life in the monastic schools. We could also take the conditions for the young who were being prepared for trades. We would not find much difference. It is actually just the same. In the earliest of those times, it was quite definitely realized that none could be brought before their 18th year to the point of real knowledge. It would have seemed absurd had one maintained that it was possible to give anyone real knowledge before the 18th year. At that time it was known among older people, especially if they wanted to teach or educate, the young cannot be brought to the point of actual knowledge. We must be capable of bringing up the young to believe in what we, according to our knowledge, hold to be true, and to lead the young to such a belief was considered a sacred task. Today this is all upside down, because what in earlier times was demanded only of the young, namely belief, is now demanded in connection with the supersensible of those who are grown up. At that time, the concept of belief was only there for those who were young, but it was regarded as something sacred. Teachers and educators would have reproached themselves for having violated their most sacred duty if they had failed to make the young believe in them out of the freshness and lively conviction of their individual human nature, so that they thus received the truth. This shade of feeling lay in all education, in all instruction. In other respects, the education and teaching of that time may today arouse a sense of antipathy because of its division into all kinds of classes and distinctions. But putting that aside, the education was such that the young could believe in the teacher. Something else was connected with this, that teachers felt that it was first of all necessary to earn the right that the young should believe in them. I shall explain this by means of an example in the monastery schools, which were the only educational institutions in the time preceding the 15th century. One had first to earn the right to be taken seriously, for this was the prerequisite upon which the belief of the young was to be founded. Human beings did not think that just because they were adults or because some authority had granted them a diploma or had hired them, the young had to believe in them. It is true that diplomas and the like played a certain outer role, even in those days. The right to be taken seriously was not earned by giving them knowledge. It is difficult for us today to make any sense of the remark, "We do not wish to impart knowledge to the young." Yet at that time, it was a matter of course that before any knowledge was imparted, the young should be made to see and to feel that one was capable of something. It was only when the young people had reached a certain age that the teachers told them what they knew. The first step was to show what one could do, and for this reason, the substance of the teaching was the trinity of grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric. These were not sciences. For it is only in the course of time that grammar has become the present pseudo-scientific monstrosity. In those times, grammar was not at all what it is today. It was the art of combining and separating thoughts and words. Instruction in grammar was the teaching of an art, and all the more so in the case of dialectic and rhetoric. Everything given was so arranged that the pupils should feel the ability of their teachers, that they should feel their teachers capable of speaking and thinking, and of letting beauty hold sway in their speaking. Grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric. This was instruction in ability, in an ability closely connected with the human activity and quickness of the teacher and educator. Today, when we speak of visual or object teaching, we keep the teaching quite apart from the personality of the teacher. We drag in every possible kind of gadget, even those dreadful calculating machines, in order that the teaching may be as impersonal as possible. We try to separate it entirely from the personal. Such a separation is not really possible. The endeavor to keep the teaching entirely apart from the personal only leads to the worst sides of teachers coming into play, and their good sides are quite unable to unfold when so much objectivity is dragged in. Thus it was a natural demand on teachers that they should first let the young feel what they were capable of in the very highest sense as human beings. They had to show their mastery of speech, their mastery of thought, and how beauty was part of their speech. Only by letting the young witness for a time what they could do was the right acquired to lead their students gradually to what can be known, to arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music, to music as it was conceived of at that time, as a permeation of the whole world order by harmony and melody. Because the teachers started with grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric, they were able later to pour into arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music as much of the artistic as is possible, when having had an artistic point of departure. Now all this has evaporated and vanished into thin air with the first dawning of intellectualism. Of the old artistic element that appeared then, we have but the scantiest remains. Here and there in certain universities, the doctor's degree still bears with it the title, quote, "Doctor of Philosophy and the Seven Liberal Arts," close quote. But you know the real state of affairs where the seven liberal arts are concerned. Historically, we can recall the famous Curtius, who taught in Berlin and was an extraordinary personality, held a diploma that was very different from his field. If you ask for what subject he actually received the Venia Legendi, you would expect it to have been for history of art, but that is not correct. His teaching certificate was for eloquentia, fluency of speech. However, already by his time this branch of knowledge was out of date. He was professor of eloquence, but in order to teach he took up history of art and dealt with it most excellently. Even at the time when Curtius was teaching, it would have been strange had eloquence been a field of instruction. Eloquence, or rhetoric, however, was one of the fundamental branches of instruction given to the young of earlier times, with the result that something thoroughly artistic came into education. But the introduction of the artistic into education was still in keeping with the old order, in which intellectual or mind-soul encountered intellectual or mind-soul. And today people are still not able to put the question from the new point of view. How must things be in human affairs if consciousness so is to meet consciousness so. As soon as education is considered in the wider sense, this question arises of itself. The question has been put for a long time, for decades, but human beings have not yet developed an active enough thinking to formulate and feel it clearly. And where do we find an answer? An answer to this question is found by learning to understand, for it is a matter of the unfolding of will and not of theoretical solution, that when children enter earthly existence, they bring with them the power of imitation. Up to the time of the change of teeth, children just imitate. Out of this power of imitation, speech is learned. Speech is, so to speak, poured into children, just as their blood circulation is poured into them when they come into earthly existence. But they should not come to a more and more conscious education by giving them, out of the consciousness soul, knowledge in the form of so-called truth. In earlier times it was said, before the 18th year children cannot know anything, so they must be led through the teacher's ability to knowledge, which they accept first as belief. Through the belief the children have developed in their younger years, the forces of knowledge will be awakened in them between the 18th and 19th years. For it is out of the inner being that the forces of knowledge must be awakened. To help the young wait until their 18th year, adults behaved in relation to youth in such a way as to show what they were capable of, afterward educating them to experience together with the teacher in a provisional way up to the 18th year what they would be expected to know later. Up to the 18th or 19th year, the quote, acquisition of knowledge, close quote, was provisional, because before the 18th or 19th year, it is not possible really to know anything. However, no teacher can convey knowledge to any child if in that child's feeling the conviction has not ripened, this teacher is capable. It would be an irresponsible beginning in regard to humanity if teachers wanted to set to work without the young believing, as a matter of course, that they are capable. Before the students came to arithmetic, arithmetic as it was understood in those days, and not the dry, abstract stuff of today, they were clear that those who were to guide them into arithmetic knew how to speak and think and had the gift of eloquence as well. When the young knew this out of their own feeling, it was a good reason for looking up to those who were older. When they know only that the teacher has a diploma, it sometimes happens that when the child is not more than 10, everything goes to pieces. The question that was living in those days must again be given life, because today consciousness soul encounters consciousness soul in human affairs. This question cannot be solved in the same way as formerly when human beings confronted each other with their mind souls. Today a different solution must be found. Naturally, we cannot return to the liberal arts, although it would be preferable to what is being done today. We must reckon with modern conditions, not the external conditions, but those dealing with the evolution of the human race. Here we must find the transition from imitation, which up to the change of teeth is natural in children, to the stage when we can bring knowledge to human beings, reckoning first upon trust and belief, and later upon their own judgment. However, there is an intermediate period, and this period is a very critical one for the young today. For this intermediate time, we must find the solution of the most significant world problem upon which the future progress, or backward steps in human evolution, or even its total fall, depends. The question is, how must adults handle children between the years of imitation and the years when knowledge can be given? Today, this is one of the most important cultural questions of all. And what was the youth movement in so far as it is to be taken seriously? It was a languishing for an answer to the cultural question about the intermediate time. And it became clear to the young that no such answer was to be found in the schools. So they drifted out into grove and meadow and into the fields. They preferred, instead of being schoolboys and girls, to become birds, birds of passage, the German Wandervögel. We We must look at life, not theories, if we want to master the great questions of world culture. If one really looks into life today, one will find that the period between the age of imitation and the age at which the human being can receive knowledge in the form of truth must be filled so that humanity does not become stunted. This must be done by giving human beings, with artistic beauty, what they need for head, heart, and will. The sevenfold nature, consisting of grammar, dialectic, rhetoric, arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music, grew out of an old cultural order as something artistic. Today, too, we need the artistic, but in accordance with the demands of the consciousness soul. It must not be specialized in the way of the seven liberal arts. During the primary school age and far beyond it, for as long as education is involved, the whole teaching must be warmed through and fired by the artistic element. During the primary school years, everything must be steeped in beauty, and in later years, beauty must rule as the interpreter of the truth. Those human beings who have not learned to walk in the ways of beauty and through beauty to capture truth will never come to the full humanity needed to meet the challenges of life. The great German writers divined this, even if its full importance was not emphasized. They were not understood, however. How clearly we see this search for truth through beauty in Goethe. Listen how he says, quote, "Art is a manifestation of secret forces of nature," close quote, which simply means that only through an artistic grasp of the world do human beings reach the living truth. Otherwise, it is dead. And Schiller's beautiful words, quote, "Only through the dawn of beauty do you penetrate to the land of knowledge," close quote. Unless we first permeate ourselves with the meaning of the path, that we can penetrate into the realm of truth only through the artistic, there can be no question of acquiring a real understanding of the supersensible world in accordance with the age of the consciousness soul. For you see, with the help of today's recognized sciences, knowledge of the human being is limited to the physical body alone. With modern science, there is no possibility of knowing anything about the human being beyond the physical body. That is why science can speak conclusively and even grandly about physiology or biology only so long as it is a question of the physical body. True, people talk about psychology. It is only known as experimental psychology. Phenomena of the life of soul are observed, are connected with the physical body. They cannot form the slightest conception of pure manifestations of the soul. Hence, they have hit upon the idea of psychophysical parallelism. Parallel lines, however, can meet only at infinity. So, too, the connection between the physical body and the soul can be understood only at infinity. Thus, psychophysical parallelism was set up. All this is symptomatic of the incapacity of the age to understand the human being. For, firstly, if one seeks to understand the human being, the power of intellectualism ceases. The human being cannot be understood out of the intellect. One may choose to adhere firmly and rigidly to intellectualism, but then one must do without knowledge of the human being. However, for that, one would have to tear out one's mind and heart, and that is impossible. If we tear it out, it withers away. The head can indeed renounce knowledge of the human being, but the mind and heart become stunted. All of our present culture is expressed out of a withered life of mind and heart. And secondly, understanding of the human being is not to be achieved with concepts that direct us to the domain of outer nature. However much we may achieve outwardly with these concepts, they cannot lead us even to the second member of the human being, namely to the etheric body or body of formative forces. Just imagine that with the methods of modern science, human beings could know as much, let us say, as they will know at the end of Earth evolution, quite a formidable amount. I will assume the existence of a very finished and very clever scientist. I will assume the existence of a very finished and very clever scientist. I'm not saying that there are not among us scientists already near this stage, for I do not think that in the future we will make much more progress in intellectualism. A different path will be taken. I have the very highest respect for the intellectualism of our learned people. Do not for a moment think that I am saying this out of a lack of respect. I mean this in all seriousness. Without a doubt, there are vast numbers of very clever scientists. Yet even were I to assume that science had reached its highest peak, it would still only be able to understand the physical body of the human being and nothing at all of the etheric body. It is not that the knowledge of the etheric body is based upon fantasy. That is not the case. It is a real perception. However, the stimulus to acquire the faculty for perceiving this most subordinate of the supersensible members of human nature can arise only out of an artistic experience of the soul. Art must become the lifeblood of the soul. The more people wish in our objective science to carefully avoid everything of the nature of art, the more are they led away from knowledge of the human being. Through the microscope and other instruments we have come to know a great deal. Yet it never leads us nearer to the etheric body, but rather farther from it. In the end, we lose entirely the path to what is a prime necessity for understanding the human being. In the case of plants, we can still use the instruments, for the plants do not concern us so intimately. The plant does not care that it is not the product of the laboratory that modern science makes it out to be. It still goes on growing under the influence of the etheric force of the cosmos and does not limit itself to the forces presumed to exist by physics and chemistry. But when we confront people, things are different. Then our feeling, our confidence, our reverence, in short, all that is in our mind, which in the age of the consciousness soul naturally rises above instinct, with the consciousness soul everything rises above instinct, depends upon our having an education that allows us to perceive something more than merely the human physical body. When teachers deprive us of insight into what the human being really is, we cannot expect those forces to flourish that help the human being face another human being in the right way. Everything depends upon the human being's ability to free the self from the shackles of mere observation and experiment. Indeed, we can value observation and experiment properly only when we have become free of them, and the simplest way of breaking free is through the artistic. Yes, when teachers stand in front of the children again, as in an earlier epoch, suited for grammar, dialectic rhetoric, that is to say, when teachers stand before the young so that their way of teaching is again artistic and all instruction is permeated by art, there will arise a different youth movement that will crowd around the teachers who are artists, because there they will draw nourishment and receive what the young must expect from those who are older. It may appear unattractive to you, but nevertheless it will arise. The youth movement cannot be a mere opposition, a mere revolt against the older generation, but then it becomes like the infant who can do nothing because it cannot receive milk from its mother. What is to be learned must be learned, but it will be learned when there is as natural an urge toward those who are older as the infant has toward its mother's milk, or as the small child feels when by imitating it learns to speak. This urge will be stimulated when the young find the artistic coming from the older generation, when truth first appears in the garb of beauty. In this way, all that is best will be kindled in the young. Not the intellect that always remains passive, but the will that stirs thinking into activity. Artistic education will be an education of the will, and it is upon the education of the will that everything else depends. Tomorrow, then, we shall continue. The end of Lecture 9.